time, he said. As soon as the proofs and sheets were ready the next morning, a car was sent to the Senate office building for Byrd and Williams. "I've got a surprise for you, Harry," Johnson said when the two senators arrived at the White House. "I've got the damn thing down under $100 billion, way under. It's only $97.9 billion. Now you can tell your friends that you forced the President of the United States to reduce the budget before you let him have his tax cut." Not only was the budget indeed below Byrd's magic figure, there was magic also in Johnson's words, appealing as they did to an old man's pride in his principles and in the victory he had won for them, and appealing also to his pride in his power. Harry Byrd could indeed know that he had forced a President of the United States to bow to his demands. The President himself was acknowledging that, admitting it to his face. Given Johnson's hatred of losing, his feeling that any defeat was humiliation, there was a sacrifice in Johnson's statement. He was admitting that he had lost, that he had been forced to bow to someone's demands, and he was admitting it face to face to the man who had beaten him. It was still the early days of his presidency, less than 7 weeks after Dallas. If the price of achieving governmental progress was such a face-to-face admission, it was a price he was still willing to pay. And not only had he paid it face-to-face, graciously, he had put it, from this man looking always for words that would touch, in words designed to touch. And they did touch. Byrd's reaction to the State of the Union speech, "I congratulate the President on his estimated reduction in federal expenditures and deficits. His references to cutting waste and extravagance have been impressive," was all Johnson could have hoped. The White House press office had been alerted to look for it. As soon as it clattered over the wire service ticker, a press office secretary tore it off, showed it to Pierre Salinger, ran with it into the Oval Office, and the President telephoned the senator and said, "I appreciate it very much." In that call, the chord of pride he had newly struck in Byrd was struck along with the old one, Byrd's affection for him. "I've got to represent the whole country and do my best," the President said. "We're going to have some differences, as we always do, but I'll tell you this. One thing I'm going to try to do, I'm going to try to stop and arrest the spending and try to be as frugal as I can make them be. You're my inspiration for doing it. And I want to work with you. I want you to advise me. I want you to be proud that you supported me in 1960. Byrd's response showed how strongly the chords resonated in him. Johnson said he wanted him to be proud of him, and the older man assured him that he already was. "That was an eloquent speech you made," he said. "You've made a good start," he said. And, as almost immediately became apparent, he was going to help him. The very day after their telephone conversation, the Finance Committee, in what the New York Times called a speed-up, held an unusually long session, in which it defeated, often by a 9-8 vote, a number of amendments. By the next week, many journalists had noted that, as the Washington Post put it, Byrd has been moving in high gear in what appeared to be a foot race with the calendar. Harry started to regard the budget, well, almost as his budget. He had gotten it down, Neil McNeil says. And because the tax reduction bill was so tied in with it, the budget, and he had done so much work on that bill, well, it was almost as if the tax bill had suddenly become his bill, too. All Byrd's help and all his power would be needed to get it passed. Developments that Johnson had not foreseen, a new line of attack orchestrated by Richard Russell and a series of last-minute amendments introduced in the Finance Committee by Republican leader Everett Dirksen and other GOP committee members, as well as by some Democratic members, to exempt the products of industries in their states from the excise taxes in the tax bill, threatened to upset Johnson's timetable, with finance suddenly faced with more work than had been anticipated, and House rules moving faster than had been anticipated, there was suddenly, thanks to Russell's maneuvers, the danger that rules might complete its work before finance and send the civil rights bill to the Senate floor before the tax bill arrived there. There was suddenly, again, the possibility that the tax bill might get behind civil rights, that it would be good night grace. But all that January, the chords were played in telephone calls in which Johnson used the tone he had used years before as a young senator, when he had sat at Harry Byrd's knee, and pride and affection overcame even the fear of what might happen if black children and white children rode in school buses together. Harry Byrd no longer wanted the tax bill, his tax bill now, in his mind, behind civil rights. He wanted his bill passed. He became, in Evans and Novak's phrase, Johnson's secret ally, and a very effective one. On Thursday morning, January 23rd, as the committee was about to complete its work, there was almost a derailment. Without warning, Dirksen suddenly introduced yet another new amendment to repeal excise taxes on luxury goods, such as jewelry and expensive handbags and luggage, and it was approved 12-5. A stunned Treasury Department estimated that the amendment would cost the government $450 million, almost $500 million, in tax revenue each year. That vote broke the dam. Three Democratic committee members, Clinton Anderson of New Mexico, Vance Hartke of Indiana, and Abraham Ribicoff of Connecticut, who had, in the interest of getting a bill passed, agreed to withdraw excise tax amendments that would benefit industries in their states, immediately decided to resubmit them. Each amendment would have to be debated individually within the committee, and the debates, as senators fought for constituencies in their states important to them, might be long ones. And there remained the other amendments that had not been taken up by the committee. Their sponsors might now want them debated individually as well. Johnson learned of these developments at 34 minutes past noon on the 23rd in a panicky phone call from George Smathers, who told him that the previous agreement to get the tax bill out fast had fallen apart. "The goddamned thing came unglued," he said, and he didn't think there was anything that could be done about it in the committee. "I don't think there's anything we can do except just take it, except Dirksen's amendment, as it is." Taking it as it was, however, meant that all the careful balancing of the budget would be undone, and the careful scheduling to ensure the tax bill arrival on the Senate floor before civil rights might be undone, too. Smathers was talking to the master of the Senate. Long before he was finished explaining that the problem was unsolvable, Johnson had thought of a way, possibly the only way, to solve it. His solution would require two far-from-routine rulings from the committee chairman, rulings that would in fact fly in the face of the committee's vote that morning. First, that the Dirksen Amendment could be brought back that afternoon and voted on again, and second, that it be brought back by a motion that lumped it in with all remaining amendments before the committee, even those that had not yet been debated, so that a single vote by the committee, a vote to defeat the Dirksen Amendment, would be a vote to defeat all the remaining amendments as well, thereby concluding the committee's work on the tax cut bill and removing the last obstacle to its release to the Senate floor. And since only five committee members had voted against the amendment before, Johnson's solution would require also that the three rebellious Democratic senators be persuaded not only to withdraw their amendments, but to reverse their vote on the Dirksen Amendment, and this time vote to defeat it. Even their three votes would not provide the nine necessary to defeat it. Not only Byrd's ruling to allow the motion, but his vote against the amendment, a fourth vote that would be reversed, would be essential. It was going to be another 9-8 thing. "I think we just gotta go right on with the bill," Smathers said, but Johnson refused to accept that. "Can't you redo it in the committee?" he demanded. "Can't you repeal what you did in the committee? Can't you put those votes together?" "I don't think so," Smathers said. "I just don't see how." "That's what I'd try to do," Lyndon Johnson said. There was little time to do it. He hung up the phone with Smathers at 12:42. The Finance Committee was scheduled to reconvene at 2:00. He told Colonel Roberts to get the three Democratic senators on the phone. Luckily, Anderson and Hartke had been in the Senate while Johnson was leader. They knew that Lyndon Johnson was a bad man to cross, but could be a good man to have on your side. And they, and Ribicoff, knew that a president had a lot of ways to help or hurt a senator. The persuasion went fast. Agreeing to withdraw his amendment, Anderson said Ribicoff would never withdraw his. "He won't do it. He won't go with anybody." "If you go with us, I'll appreciate it and I'll remember it," Johnson told Ribicoff. He had put Rybakov on finance, he told him. When you wanted to go on that committee, I just stood up and said, by God, it's going to be. Now I just want one vote, one motion, and I want to get that bill out of there, and I've got to have it, Abe. Rybakov said that his amendment is for something in my home state that's already been announced, and that he had a problem with saving face with his constituency. I'll save your face, Johnson said. You save my face this afternoon, and I'll save your face tomorrow. Okay, Mr. President, was the reply. When Hartke said he needed to have a separate vote on his amendment because it was vital to a company in Indiana, Johnson said he couldn't have it. We want to just have a general vote. See if you can't do that for me. Laughing, Hartke said, all right. I'll do something for you, Johnson said. I know you will, Hartke replied. Johnson's calls to the three senators had lasted a total of 9 minutes. But of course, despite his success with the senators, everything depended on Byrd, on his rulings, and on his vote, too. For all his telephoning, Johnson was still one vote short. He telephoned Byrd to ask him to allow the motion for a single vote that very afternoon, and then on that vote to vote no. I hope you can help, Johnson told the chairman in a call to Byrd's office at 1:17. Because that, Dirksen amendment, throws everything out of caboodle if we lose $450 million. All the careful calculations. If you'll go with me on that, we can do it. Just have one general motion that covers them all. Byrd said he would have a problem doing that because he had already committed himself to vote in favor of several individual excise tax amendments, but Johnson kept pleading. I'll do the best I can, Byrd said finally. Help me, Harry, Lyndon Johnson said. Late that afternoon, Byrd called the Oval Office, getting the same White House switchboard operator on the line who had connected him to the president that morning. He was so excited that he delivered his news to her, not the president. Well, I want to tell you, the president called me this morning in regard to votes, he said. Yes, sir, the operator said. We had a 9-8 vote, Byrd said. My vote was the one that carried it his way. Oh, wonderful, the operator said. The senator and the operator laughed together. Tell him, and I won't bother him, but 9-8 was about cutting out these reductions of the excise taxes, you know. The operator said she did know. Byrd told her that he had ruled that all the reductions could be lumped together in a single bill, and they were taken out of the bill by 9-8. The operator gave another long oh of admiration. My vote, the old senator said proudly. The call ended with the operator saying, I'll tell him. She evidently did, because a few minutes later her boss called Byrd. That Harry Byrd, Lyndon Johnson said, he can do anything. It was a moment for remembering long ago days. You've learned to count since I left up there, Johnson said. I used to do your counting, but when you can beat them 9-8, you're doing all right. There was still a need for haste. By that last 9-8 vote, the committee had finally finished its hearings on the tax bill, but it could not go to the Senate floor until the committee's majority report on the bill was written, printed, and filed with the Secretary of the Senate. And since a tax bill report was a complex document, the committee's staff usually took a week or more to write it. And over in the House, Republicans, eager to avoid further reminders about whose party they were the party of, had agreed that the Civil Rights Bill would be reported out of rules and passed by the entire House before members left town on February 8th to begin giving speeches for Lincoln's birthday, February 12th. The clock is ticking, Johnson told reporters. The staff couldn't take a week. You make them write that majority report over the weekend, Harry, Johnson urged Byrd when he spoke to him that Thursday evening. They're going to pass this other bill, the Civil Rights Bill, before Lincoln's birthday, and I want to get this tax bill out of the way before that Civil Rights Bill gets there. Byrd made them, and Johnson made them. Startled officials at the government printing office picked up their telephones to find that the caller was the president, ordering them not to close for the weekend in case the Finance Committee report was completed, one account said. Then a flabbergasted Elizabeth Springer picked up the phone to find the President of the United States on the line to tell her that the printing office was waiting for the manuscript. No other president of the United States, this account said, had ever been quite so familiar with the minutiae of the legislative process. Springer's staff couldn't finish writing the report over the weekend, as it turned out, but they finished it on Tuesday, January 28th. Record time, the Washington Post reported. And the government printing office printed it the same day, and on that same day it was filed with the Senate, and Mansfield announced that no other matter would be allowed on the floor until the tax bill was passed, which it was on February 7th, 3 days before the Civil Rights Bill passed the House. Difficult though it had been to pass the tax cut bill, the effort would be justified by the results. The reductions instituted by the bill and the increased spending they inspired were a key element in what would become one of the longest economic expansions in American history. And the bill was passed because of what Lyndon Johnson had done during those first days after he was thrown, with no warning and no preparation, into the budget and tax cut fights, thrown into them and presented at the same time with deadlines that had to be met and met very quickly. His grasp in an instant of the reality that underlay the haggling over the budget, that Byrd had to be given what he wanted, his promise to let Byrd see the figures for himself, and most important, his ability to take advantage of the affection and trust of an older man to get the ungettable Harry Byrd. These were the crucial elements in breaking a deadlock that, before November 22nd, had seemed all but unbreakable. Chapter 23. In the Books of Law. The Civil Rights Bill arrived in the Senate as early as it did, on February 10th, because of the outcome of the early skirmish on that bill, the skirmish that had begun before Christmas to pry civil rights loose from Judge Smith's House Rules Committee. That encounter had ended almost on schedule, on the schedule which back in December Smith and House Republican Leader Halleck had agreed to accept. Not that that had been an indication of good faith on the part of the judge. Hardly had Smith gaveled the Rules Committee into order on January 9th to open its hearings on the bill, when his agreement began to demonstrate a certain elasticity. During testimony by the very first witness, House Judiciary Committee Chairman Emanuel Seller of New York, the undercurrent of bitter feelings over the measure began showing, UPI reported, as Smith accused Seller of railroading the bill through his committee. "We don't railroad bills through," Seller said. "Do you prefer the word strong-armed?" Smith asked. And it had immediately become apparent that railroading or strong-arming was not a crime of which the judge himself was going to be guilty. He allowed each witness to testify at such length, asking them innumerable questions himself and allowing another Southern stalwart, Representative William M. Collmer of Mississippi, to ask innumerable others, going over the same points hour after hour, the Times reported, that after 7 days of hearings, only 8 of the 30 witnesses scheduled to testify had been heard. At that pace, the schedule that had been agreed upon in December, that the hearings would not last longer than 12 days, was rapidly becoming meaningless. That schedule was going to be accelerated, however. Seller began mentioning to reporters the lever that Johnson had put in place in December with his telephone call to Richard Bolling, the lever behind which the president had thrown his full weight, and that would, if pushed far enough, subject Smith to the indignity of having his committee discharged from consideration of the bill. Seller said he certainly expected Smith to live up to the agreement and complete the hearings expeditiously. But, UPI reported, Seller also made clear that efforts to get enough votes for a discharge petition, which could bypass the committee if there were a prolonged stall, would not be abandoned. Johnson told Larry O'Brien to go back to work rounding up signatures to add to the 130 that had been placed on the petition before Christmas. He advised O'Brien what to say to Republicans. "What I'd say to them is this. I don't want the party of Lincoln to go down in history as being unwilling to sign the statement, petition. I don't want your name to be off of there. That's a golden honor roll. It's an honor roll. They are the men who care. Those men whose name is signed to that. I want your name on it, in these towns." And when that lever appeared to be stuck, Johnson inserted another one. Despite O'Brien's efforts, on January 18th, the petition still bore only 178 signatures, 40 short of the required number. And since 153 of them were Democratic signatures, not too many more could be expected from the Democratic side of the House. And while most of the necessary 40 would have to come from the Republican side, Republican leaders, from Halleck on down, were still advising GOP congressmen not to circumvent traditional House procedure by signing. Republican members of the Rules Committee who wanted the bill released were getting the same advice, and the Times reported were still reluctant to take it away from the chairman. But at noon on January 18th, Charles Halleck was in the Oval Office. Using logic at first, as Johnson was later to recall, I said, if I were you, Charlie, I wouldn't dare go out and try to make a Lincoln birthday speech that'll laugh you out of the goddamn park when Howard Smith's got his foot on Lincoln's neck. You'd better get that bill out before then. And then he used a blunter weapon. Picking up the telephone with Halleck sitting in front of him, the president called NASA Administrator James Webb about requests the Republican leader had made of NASA, one of them concerning Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana, the largest educational institution in his congressional district. He wants to know what he can tell his people when he's running for re-election that he's done for them lately, and he wants to know what we can do for Purdue, Johnson told Webb. I need to do anything I can for Charlie Halleck. Now, isn't there something you can do? Webb replied that he would talk with him and work out something that he'll come back to you and tell you he's pleased with. Johnson set up a time for the two men to meet. And then, after Halleck had left the Oval Office, Johnson got down to the nut cutting. Now, Jim, he said, this is it. Let's help him. Webb said he would certainly do everything I can, and I hope when he comes back to you, he'll tell you that I've... Hoping, however, was not what Lyndon Johnson had in mind. The civil rights bill was still stalled. If he's not satisfied when he comes back to me, why then I'm going to be talking to you again, he said. Webb got the message. After meeting with Halleck on January 21st, he telephoned the president. I showed him that we could do some things at Purdue, Webb said. A building that would run $750,000 and we're talking about some research grants and contracts. Grants and contracts for which he was careful to say Purdue was well qualified. And Webb, having worked for Lyndon Johnson for 15 years, knew that once Johnson had found a weapon that would help him control a man, he liked to keep it in place for further use. He had things worked out, the NASA administrator said, to facilitate Halleck's cooperation not only immediately but in the future as well. The key research grant would be spread over 3 years and then renewed each year, he said. The net effect, Mr. President, is that if you tell him that you're willing to follow this policy as long as he cooperates with you, I can implement it on an installment basis. In other words, the minute he kicks over the traces, we stop the installment. Sounds good, Lyndon Johnson said. Whether or not the contracts for Purdue had anything to do with it, the following day, January 22nd, some Republican members of the Rules Committee began doing what Halleck had previously advised them not to do, meeting with Democratic committee members to devise a move to force Judge Smith to speed up the civil rights hearings and release the bill to the floor. All during the next morning, Thursday, January 23rd, while the hearings were going on, members were leaving the hearing to take calls from party leaders, the Times reported, and reports were circulating that Republican signatures, previously withheld from the petition, were about to be added to it. Just before lunch, Judge Smith surrendered, saying, I have been here long enough to know the facts of life. He announced that he had agreed to a definite date on which the hearings would end, January 30th, and said the bill will be voted out and sent to the floor on that date. By the agreement, the Times said, Mr. Smith was spared the humiliation of having the bill taken away from him by his committee. At a press conference on Saturday, January 25th, Johnson said he was very happy about the progress being made in civil rights. I have said to the Republican leadership that I thought it would be rather unbecoming to go out and talk about Lincoln when we still had the civil rights bill that Lincoln would be so interested in locked up in a committee that couldn't act on it. Whatever the reasons, the Rules Committee sent the bill to the floor of the House on January 30th, and the House passed it on February 10th, sending it to the Senate. Congress, Marquis Childs wrote, is moving on the tax cut and civil rights at a pace that a short time ago seemed inconceivable. That pace was about to grind to a halt, for the bill was in the Senate now, the Senate that was the graveyard of civil rights bills. In the 1964 fight to pass John F. Kennedy's civil rights bill, Johnson would have a great advantage. The transformation, the sympathetic atmosphere for his program that Kennedy's death had created in Washington. But sympathy for civil rights, majority opinion in the nation, majority opinion even in the Senate, had collided with the Senate's Southern Caucus before and had lost every time. New lines of attack would be necessary. One would be the line that Johnson had spelled out to Sorensen in June. Since the South used other administration bills as hostages against civil rights, don't give them any hostages. By February 10th, when the Civil Rights Bill arrived in the Senate, the most valuable hostage, the tax cut bill, was out of the South's clutches, locked and key in the storm cellar of completed legislation, and so were the appropriations bills. And Johnson made sure that no other bills would wander onto the battlefield to be captured and held hostage. After the Civil Rights Bill got to the floor, by a 54-37 vote that ended a determined Southern attempt to refer it instead to the Judiciary Committee chaired by Mississippi's Eastland, he told Larry O'Brien and his other legislative aides that no new bills would be sent to the Senate by the White House. "They can filibuster until hell freezes over," he said. "I'm not going to put anything else on that floor until this is done." Then there was the question of compromises. The bill had finally been passed by the House Judiciary Committee largely because of the assistance of its ranking Republican member, William McCulloch of Ohio, a quietly determined champion of civil rights. Angered by the fact that desperately needed sections of both the 1957 and 1960 civil rights bills, in particular fair employment and public accommodations, had been bargained away in return for the South's agreement not to filibuster, McCulloch had, in dealing with Robert Kennedy and Justice Department aides Marshall and Katzenbach, made his support of the Kennedy bill conditional on a promise that, as Katzenbach was to put it, "We not give away in the Senate any provisions of the House bill." Not only was McCulloch's position on a civil rights bill influential with his GOP House colleagues, one tenet of GOP leader Halleck's allegiance to House prerogatives was his policy of treating the ranking GOP member of each committee as, in effect, his party's chairman on that committee and supporting his recommendations, in this case McCulloch's no-compromise position, on legislation. Feeling, therefore, that only McCulloch's support could get the bill through Judiciary, Robert Kennedy had given him the unequivocal no-compromise promise he demanded. In the Senate, however, there was someone who was insisting on compromise, and he was the only senator who could deliver the Republican votes necessary for cloture. Everett Dirksen had promised Katzenbach in 1963, shortly before President Kennedy's assassination, that he would deliver them, that this bill will come to a vote in the Senate. But Dirksen's promises always had considerable elasticity to them, and now, in 1964, discussing the bill with Katzenbach and Burke Marshall, the two Kennedy men discovered, as Katzenbach puts it, that he obviously wanted the bill rewritten, to appear different, even if there were no substantive changes, so that he could explain to his colleagues all the changes he had negotiated. Changes, substantive or not, meant negotiations, compromise. And on two points, the public accommodations and fair employment sections, the changes Dirksen wanted were substantive. Under President Kennedy, the conviction in Washington had been, as Evans and Novak expressed it, that one or both of these sections would have been sacrificed to eliminate or at least shorten a Southern filibuster, and that there would be other compromises as well, for without them the bill could not get through the Senate. And Dirksen was confident that the situation would be no different under the new president. The Republican leader expected President Johnson to be willing, as in the past, to negotiate some compromise, Katzenbach says. Compromises had always been a key element in Southern strategy because of the time element that was so decisive. Working out each one required lengthy negotiations behind closed doors and then lengthy discussions on the Senate floor. Not filibusters exactly, but a time-consuming, calendar-consuming part of normal legislative business. and each compromise meant, of course, that the Senate bill would be different from the bill the House had approved, and that, therefore, after the Senate passed its version of the bill, it would have to go to a Senate-House conference committee so that the changes could be reconciled, one of those conference committees behind whose closed doors bills could be emasculated or delayed indefinitely without public explanation. And, it would become apparent not long after the bill reached the Senate in 1964, compromise was going to be a Southern tactic again. We knew that there was no way in hell we could muster the necessary votes to defeat the Civil Rights Bill, but we thought we could filibuster long enough to get the other side to agree to amendments that would make it less offensive, is the way Russell's Georgia colleague Herman Talmadge puts it. Johnson refused to compromise. In public, in answer to a press conference question about the possibility of one, he said, "I'm in favor of passing it, the bill, in the Senate exactly in its present form." In private, talking to legislative leaders, he had a more pungent phrase. "There will be no wheels and no deals." There was, as always, a political calculation behind his stance. "I knew," he was to tell Doris Goodwin, "that if I didn't get out in front on this issue, the liberals would get me. I had to produce a civil rights bill that was even stronger than the one they'd have gotten if Kennedy had lived." And there was, as always, something more than calculation. Assuring Richard Goodwin there would be no compromises on civil rights, "I'm not going to bend an inch," he added. "In the Senate, as leader, I did the best I could, but I had to be careful. But I always vowed that if I ever had the power, I'd make sure every Negro had the same chance as every white man. Now I have it, and I'm going to use it." Telling Robert Kennedy, "I'll do on the bill just what you think is best on the bill. We won't do anything that you don't want to do," Johnson put the Attorney General out front in the 1964 battle. For political reasons, it made a lot of sense, Kennedy was to note. His partisans would have difficulty finding fault with the bill if he was in charge of it. And Kennedy and his Justice Department aides would play a key role in it. And since this was a battle in the Senate, a body fiercely jealous of its prerogatives, and a president's hand couldn't be too visible there, the floor leader of the bill, after Mansfield had declined the assignment, became the Democrats' assistant leader, Hubert Humphrey. Summoning Humphrey to the Oval Office, Johnson told him, Humphrey was to recall, that, "You have this great opportunity now, Hubert, but you liberals will never deliver. You don't know the rules of the Senate, and your liberal friends will be off making speeches when they ought to be present." "I would have been outraged if he hadn't been basically right and historically accurate," Humphrey was to say, and he was to say Johnson was being accurate about him, too. "He had sized me up. He knew very well that I would say, 'Damn you, I'll show you.'" And then, having made his point, he shifted the conversation, and more quietly and equally firmly, he promised he would back me to the hilt. As I left, he stood and moved towards me with his towering intensity. "Call me whenever there's trouble or anything you want me to do." He knew just how to get to me, Humphrey says. Humphrey had always had a gift for oratory and for friendship, and all through the Civil Rights Battle of 1964, he employed both gifts in eloquent speeches and in keeping the Senate debate as civil as possible. "I marveled at the way he handled the bill's opponents," a liberal senator recalls. "He always kept his ebullient manner and would talk with the Southerners. He was always genial and friendly, thus keeping the debate from becoming vicious." He had never had a gift for, or even much interest in, the more pragmatic requirements of Senate warfare, for learning and using the rules. "Russell knew all the rules and how to use them," Johnson had told him in that Oval Office lecture. He, Johnson, said liberals had never really worked to understand the rules and how to use them, and that we never organized effectively, predicting that we would fall apart in dissension, be absent when quorum calls were made and when critical votes were taken. Nor had he ever had a gift for organization, or for counting votes without false optimism. Now, however, he learned the rules, and he organized his forces so that the rules couldn't be so easily used against them. After the bill got to the floor, a series of Russell maneuvers delayed its being made the pending business until March 30th, when the filibuster began. A key Southern tactic had always been the quorum call, a demand, often in the middle of the night, that the chair call the roll to determine if the number of senators present was the number required, 51, to conduct business. Each senator is allowed to speak only twice within a legislative day. But if within the time limit the required 51 couldn't be rounded up, the Senate was automatically adjourned. The next session would therefore be a new legislative day, and Southern senators who had already spoken twice in the previous day could start all over again with two more speeches. Making sure that 51 senators could be rounded up was perhaps the hardest part of managing the forces against a filibuster, Nicholas Katzenbach was to say. Humphrey organized liberal Democrats and the few liberal Republicans into rotating platoons, so that only once during the entire filibuster were the liberals unable to muster a quorum. To respond on the floor to Southern attacks on the substance of the bill, he appointed floor captains, each with a team of four or five senators under him, to defend each major section. This gave the senators, as Humphrey noted, a chance to debate the bill and get some press for themselves, to be known as part of the team fighting for civil rights. They seemed to like it. Each morning, he, the liberal Republican whip Thomas Kuchel of California, their floor captains, civil rights leaders, Robert Kennedy aides, and lobbyists from organized labor, met in Humphrey's office. One writer called it a veritable war room with organization charts, duty rosters, and progress calendars, to anticipate Southern maneuvers and map out ways to counter them. And if Hubert Humphrey had never learned to count, now Lyndon Johnson taught him how. Suddenly, his thinking was no longer so wishful. Of the 67 Democrats, 23 or 24 were Southerners or border state senators, unalterably opposed to desegregation. So no more than 44 Democratic votes could be counted on to vote for cloture. Liberal Republican votes, at most, brought the total to only about 56 or 57. Somewhere we would have to pick up about 10 or 11 additional votes. And, Humphrey saw, the only place to get them was from traditionally conservative Midwestern Republicans, an unlikely source. And Johnson reminded him of what he knew, that there was only one way to get those votes. He said, "Now you know that this bill can't pass unless you get Ev Dirksen." And he said, "You and I are going to get him. You've got to let him have a piece of the action. He's got to look good all the time." Humphrey made the Republican leader look good. Seeing that he had a sense of history, he gave Dirksen a place in it, a prominent place. Although Dirksen had announced his opposition to the Fair Employment and Public Accommodations sections, Humphrey, appearing on Meet the Press on March 8th, ignored his statements. "He is a man who thinks of his country before he thinks of his party, and I sincerely believe that when Senator Dirksen has to face the moment of decision, where his influence and where his leadership will be required to give us the votes that are necessary to pass this bill, he will not be found wanting." "Boy, that was just right," Lyndon Johnson said in a phone call afterwards, as Humphrey would recall. "You're doing just right now. You just keep at that. You get in there to see Dirksen. You drink with Dirksen. You talk to Dirksen. You listen to Dirksen." The gentle pressure left room for him to be the historically important figure in our struggle, the statesman above partisanship, the master builder of a legislative edifice that would last forever, Humphrey was to say. But, he says, as much as Dirksen liked the stroking, if he thought we had no chance, he would have kept his distance, or insisted on major compromises as the price for his support. So therefore, Humphrey says, of the greatest importance was President Johnson's public and private pronouncements that no compromises were possible this time, that it was going to be a strong bill or nothing. All that spring, all through April and May, the battle would go on. In Mississippi, clergymen arriving from the north were given orientation sessions that included instructions on how to protect themselves after they had been knocked down. Protection of the kidneys against assailants' kicks was emphasized. Not that the instructions always helped. A Cleveland rabbi was seriously injured when he was hit in the head with an iron bar. These volunteers were, of course, joining local black civil rights workers who had been risking their lives for years, and like them were virtually without protection, with nowhere to turn for help. Many of the beatings took place as policemen or state troopers watched. And looming over the volunteers always was the specter of jail, and what might happen to them in jail. The officers forced me to unclothe and lie on my back. One of the officers beat me between my legs with a belt, wrote Bessie Turner. The sacrifices made in Mississippi would include the lives of three young civil rights workers, James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, a young black man and two young white Jewish men from New York City, who were arrested by a deputy sheriff, released into a Ku Klux Klan ambush, and murdered. Eloquent though Martin Luther King's speeches might be, for his aides, each speech was an occasion for dread. A mob might form, one explained. They came right into the Negro neighborhood a few months ago to get them at the civil rights office. His public appearances had to be scheduled carefully. I don't like to have Dr. King on the road at night. In Washington, meanwhile, students Speak for Civil Rights were holding daily rallies near the base of the Washington Monument. Making what they called a pilgrimage to Washington, students from 75 religious seminaries from around the country divided into three-member teams, a Catholic, a Protestant, and a Jew, to begin a 24-hour-a-day vigil at the Lincoln Memorial to pray for the bill's passage, a vigil they pledged wouldn't end until it passed. Clergymen were playing a larger and larger role. Meeting on April 1st, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights arranged for a daily prayer service, led by a rabbi or a minister or a priest, to be held in a Lutheran church on Capitol Hill 1 hour before the Senate convened each day. On April 28th, the National Interreligious Convocation in Support of Civil Rights began at Georgetown University. More than 6,000 people attended. Ministers, priests, and rabbis fanned out to Capitol Hill. They crammed the galleries next to the observers, like Joseph Rao and Clarence Mitchell, who had been there for years. You couldn't turn around, there wasn't a clerical collar next to you, Rao recalls. And they visited, delegation after delegation, the offices of the senators whose votes were needed for cloture. The clergymen helped shift the tide of battle off the familiar and hostile terrain in which civil rights had time after time become mired in the Senate. This was kind of like getting an army with new fresh guns, fresh rations. It made all the difference in the world, Rao says. These reinforcements concentrated their efforts in states, mostly Midwestern, mostly Republican, mostly conservative, in which there had never been much interest in, let alone sentiment for, civil rights. In these states, labor unions and the NAACP and other African-American organizations had relatively few members. That wasn't true of churches, and the clergymen stayed in Washington to see the fight through. This was the first time that I ever recalled seeing Catholic nuns away from the convents for more than a few days, says James Hamilton of the National Council of Churches. There was agreement among religious groups that this was a priority issue and other things had to be laid aside. And the issue was, thanks to Johnson, finally understood. Senators from these states found themselves no longer able to maintain that they weren't against civil rights, but only against changing inviolable Senate procedure by cutting off debate through cloture. Just wait until these senators start hearing from the church people, Humphrey had predicted, and the prediction was borne out. Walking off the Senate floor after supporting the civil rights forces on a vote that defeated a Russell parliamentary maneuver, Munt said, I hope that satisfies those two goddamned bishops who called me last night. As for the president, on April 29th, Dirksen went to the White House. He went in blustering, telling reporters that he was going to let the president know that only compromise would produce the necessary Republican votes for cloture. You say you want the House bill without any change. Well, in my humble opinion, you are not going to get it. Now it's your play. What do you have to say? His comments when he came out were in a very different tone. What Johnson had had to say was apparently very little, or at any rate nothing that Dirksen wanted to repeat. To reporters' questions about civil rights, the Republican leader said that he and the president had barely touched on the subject. Johnson maintained his public posture of knowing nothing about the tactics being used. As president, I don't try to involve myself in the procedure of the Senate, he said during a press conference in May. I think Senator Mansfield and Senator Humphrey are much closer to the situation than I am. I'm not trying to dodge you, I just don't know. Asked during another press conference about a specific amendment that was being proposed, he said, "All I know is what I read in the papers." In reality, however, he knew all the tactics, devising many of them himself, thinking ahead to the tactics Russell would use to counter them, and how those tactics could then be countered in turn. And the generals carrying out his tactics knew that he was looking over their shoulders, with little patience. After the weekly congressional leaders' breakfasts, which one leader likened to battlefield briefings, Humphrey said that he often left the White House unable to remember whether or not he had actually eaten anything. And when, as spring was turning into summer, the votes for cloture were still not there, Johnson took, behind the scenes, a more direct hand. Southerners were not the only Democrats opposed to the concept of cloture. Senators from sparsely populated states were reluctant to support it because the right to filibuster was their best defense against the power of the larger states. Many of the more sparsely populated states were western states, however, western states with requests for dams, reclamation projects, irrigation projects, funding for their vast national parks, before the Department of the Interior. Johnson had Secretary of the Interior Udall tell Western senators that while I couldn't argue with them that they were wrong in principle, I did suggest to them that they should make an exception in this case. Exceptions began to be made by Anderson of New Mexico, Monroney of Oklahoma, Cannon of Nevada. No senator had been more adamantly opposed to cloture than Carl Hayden, but Hayden's lifelong ambition was to solve Arizona's water shortage with the Central Arizona Water Project. And at age 87, time for satisfying ambitions was growing short. Johnson suggested that a Hayden vote for cloture would advance the project. Hayden said that if his vote was needed to obtain cloture, Johnson could have it. Acts of God, natural disasters, were enlisted in the cause. There was an earthquake in Alaska. Johnson wanted to send $50 million in emergency assistance, but Mansfield and Humphrey were afraid that if they allowed civil rights to be removed from the floor even temporarily to allow the necessary disaster relief bill to be brought there, Russell would block civil rights from being brought back. Johnson thought of a procedure that would prevent Russell from doing that and telephoned Mansfield. "Mike, these people in Alaska are suffering and they've got no money. I don't want to be in a position of interfering with what you all are doing in the Senate for obvious reasons. But it is a real emergency, and there's a lot of suffering taking place." Alaska's two senators, Ernest Gruening and Edward L. Bartlett, wanted to get home as quickly as possible. They were told that Air Force Two was waiting for them at Andrews. On May 13th, Gruening told Humphrey, "I am prepared before long to vote for cloture." Sacrifice, prayers, persuasion. As May began, the votes were nevertheless still not there for cloture. And on July 7th, the Senate was going to recess for the Republican convention, at which it was now becoming more clear the nominee was likely to be Goldwater, still unalterably opposed to cloture and the civil rights bill. His nomination would harden the resistance of conservative Republicans to both, since a vote for either one would be a vote against the position of their party's presidential nominee. And in November, there would be an election not only for president, but for 33 Senate seats. Humphrey knew, as one account of the bill says, that the daily sessions would be drawn out until one-third of the Senate would be anxious to get out campaigning. Time was growing very short. The key, the only key, was still Dirksen. Having learned, from his visit to the Oval Office, as another account puts it, that the president was not going to make any deal, the minority leader had decided it was time to talk with Humphrey and company. The courtship of Dirksen had never stopped. "We are carving out the statesman's niche and bathing it with blue lights and hoping that Dirksen will find it irresistible to step into it," the Democratic aide said. Other reasons for the Republican leader to give in were becoming more compelling. It was an election year, and he didn't need the polls to know which way the political tide was running. And after all, as one account puts it, the Republicans were the party of Lincoln. Dirksen was from Illinois, Lincoln's state. His party were inheritors of a grand legacy that Dirksen knew he could preserve or destroy. Watching the canny GOP leader wrestle with civil rights, Herman Talmadge got the sinking feeling that he wasn't about to let Republicans be on the wrong side of history. Anxious to show that he had contributed something to the bill, Dirksen proposed a series of amendments. "I'm going to be against them until I sign them," Johnson told Humphrey privately. Several, generally inconsequential in their effect, were cleared by Robert Kennedy with McCulloch to make sure he wouldn't object, and then were added to the bill on May 12th. Dirksen agreed that the time for cloture had arrived. When Johnson telephoned him, the Republican leader said he had told Russell that morning, "Dick, I think we've gone far enough now." He promised Johnson, "We'll see what we can do about procedure to get this thing on the road and buttoned up." "You're worthy of the land of Lincoln," Johnson said, "and the man from Illinois is going to pass the bill, and I'll see that you get proper attention and credit." Persuading enough Republicans to go along would prove to be difficult. Although on May 20th, following a bitterly divided Republican caucus, Dirksen called in reporters to tell them that the bill was going to pass because civil rights was an idea whose time has come, he still didn't have enough votes, and neither did Humphrey. Russell suddenly began pressing for amendments to be brought to the floor. Amendments could be filibustered. Humphrey and Mansfield had to stall. "We need more time to nail down those cloture votes," Humphrey said on June 4th. The cloture motion was passed by a 71-29 vote on June 10th, after a filibuster of 57 days that was the longest in Senate history. 23 Democrats voted against that motion. 44 votes from the Democratic side was all it got. But thanks to Dirksen, 27 Republicans voted for it. Only 6, including Goldwater, remained opposed. There ensued another series of floor fights over proposed amendments to the bill before its passage, 73-27, came on June 19th. Thousands of people crowded around the Senate wing of the Capitol, cheering and applauding senators as they came out. When Humphrey emerged 3 hours later, they were still waiting to cheer him. Because of the amendments that had been added, the bill then had to go back to the House, to Judge Smith's House Rules Committee. But overriding the judge, McCulloch, Bolling, Clarence Brown, and their allies got it released from rules to the floor, with a rule allowing only 1 hour debate on June 30th, and the debate occurred on July 1st. On July 2nd, it passed the House. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 into law that evening, 8 days before the Republican National Convention and the national presidential season opened. "We have talked long enough about civil rights," Lyndon Johnson had said. "It is time to write it in the books of law, to embody justice and equality in legislation. It would require another piece of legislation, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, to give black Americans the weapon, the vote, that this master of power felt would be decisive because it would give them," he said, "the power to do the rest for themselves." The 1965 Act would be passed after another titanic struggle, in which, with men and women and children, many children, being beaten in Selma on their way to the Edmund Pettus Bridge, singing "We Shall Overcome" as they marched into tear gas and billy clubs and bullwhips, Lyndon Johnson went before Congress and said, "We shall overcome," thereby adopting the civil rights rallying cry as his own. When Martin Luther King, watching the speech on television in Selma, heard Johnson say that, he began to cry, the first time his assistants had ever seen him cry. For a fuller description of Johnson's speech and its antecedents, and of Dr. King's reaction, see Means of Assent, pages Roman 13 to Roman 20. In 1965, Johnson was able to deploy from the Oval Office more weapons than he had available the year before. James Farmer, sitting beside the president as he used the telephone, heard him cajoling, threatening, everything else, whatever was necessary, to get the bill passed. To bring black Americans more fully into the political system, he had to break the power of the South in the Senate. And he broke it. It was Abraham Lincoln who struck off the chains of black Americans, I have written, but it was Lyndon Johnson who led them into voting booths, closed democracy's sacred curtain behind them, placed their hands upon the lever that gave them a hold on their own destiny, made them at last and forever a true part of American political life. How true a part? 43 years later, A mere blink of history's eye, a black American, Barack Obama, was sitting behind the desk in the Oval Office. The 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act would not be Lyndon Johnson's only victories in the fight for social justice. Other bills passed during his administration made strides toward ending discrimination in public accommodations, in education, employment, even in private housing. Almost a century after Abraham Lincoln had freed black men and women from slavery, black men and women and Mexican-American men and women, and indeed most Americans of color, still did not enjoy many of the rights which America supposedly guaranteed its citizens, I have written. It was Lyndon Johnson who gave them those rights. Lincoln had been president during the 19th century. During the 20th century, of all its 17 American presidents, Lyndon Baines Johnson was the greatest champion that black Americans and Mexican Americans and indeed all Americans of color had in the White House. The greatest champion they had in all the halls of government. With the single exception of Lincoln, he was the greatest champion with a white skin that they had in the history of the Republic. He was to become the lawmaker for the poor and the downtrodden and the oppressed. He was to be the bearer of at least a measure of social justice to those whom social justice had so long been denied, the restorer of at least a measure of dignity to those who so desperately needed to be given some dignity, the redeemer of the promises made by them to America. It is time to write it in the books of law. By the time Lyndon Johnson left office, he had done a lot of writing in those books, had become, above all presidents save Lincoln, the codifier of compassion, the president who, as I have said, wrote mercy and justice into the statute books by which America was governed. And as president he had begun to do that writing, had taken a small but crucial, ineluctable first step toward breaking the century-old barriers that, at the time he took office, still stood against civil rights on Capitol Hill. With that telephone call he had made to Representative Bolling on December 2, 1963, with that decision he had made so early in his presidency to support the discharge petition, with that decision he made when he realized that only one lever was available to him, to lean into it with all his might. Chapter 24. Defeating Despair. Back in January, when Lyndon Johnson had delivered his State of the Union address, the Attorney General was sitting at the end of the row of cabinet members. His presence at the speech, coupled with his return to his duties at the Justice Department, were celebrated the next morning on the front page of the New York Times under the headline, Robert Kennedy Defeats Despair. For those who had been watching him during the speech, however, it was difficult to credit that assessment. He applauded occasionally, but for the most part sat with his arms folded across his chest, his face expressionless, inscrutable, somber, withdrawn, as if he was remote from the scene in which he was participating. And friends and aides knew that if in fact despair was a foe, his battle with it was far from over. During the 3 days of memorial ceremonies, he had never been far from Jackie's side, standing behind her, still as a statue, pale and grave, but dry-eyed, resolute, seemingly calm. Chuck Spalding would have thought he was controlled had he not heard the question Robert Kennedy sobbed out when he thought no one could hear. In the weeks thereafter, however, his grief became so obvious that, his aide Ed Guthman says, it was painful to see him. He lost so much weight that his collars gaped away from his neck, and his suits no longer fit. Some of the clothes that he insisted on wearing would have been too large for him anyway. An old tweed overcoat of his brother's, the president's bomber jacket with the presidential seal. As the weeks passed, he grew even thinner, the hollows in his cheeks and around his eyes deeper, as if, a friend says, he was being devoured by grief. For men who adored him, the fact that he so seldom spoke of what he was feeling was especially poignant. It was, perhaps, that he held his grief inwardly so tightly that made it so hard for others to bear, Guthman says. Douglas Dillon offered him his house at Hobe Sound in Florida for Thanksgiving, and he went there with Ethel and a few aides. At Hobe Sound, the Attorney General was the most shattered man I had ever seen in my life, Pierre Salinger says. Bobby had almost ceased to function. He walked alone for hours. Try though he did to resume work at Justice, he couldn't concentrate on it. In the middle of a meeting, his expression went blank, and he would stare out a window, absorbed in his own thoughts, numbed by sorrow and depression. Sometimes, jumping out of his chair, he would hurry out of the room and people would see him walking, often coatless in the freezing December weather, up Constitution Avenue, hunched, slight, frail-looking, unseeing. Long after midnight, the Secret Service agents on guard at Hickory Hill would see a light in the master bedroom go on, and a few minutes later Bobby would drive off, not to return until dawn. Sometimes he would have telephoned John Siegenthaler to tell him he would pick him up. He was wearing that bomber jacket. Let's pay Johnny a visit. Arlington Cemetery would be locked, but Bobby had found a way in. We scale the wall. Robert Kennedy would kneel, sometimes for hours, beside John Kennedy's grave. He was just inconsolable, Siegenthaler says. He was in perpetual pain. It was awful to watch. Decades later, another aide, William Vandenhoevel, would say, I don't think I ever saw human grief expressed as in the face of Robert Kennedy after the assassination. As another account puts it, so complete was his withdrawal, so scant his interest in his own future and public life, that for a time members of the family felt that the political succession of the Kennedys, by Robert Kennedy's choice, might settle on his brother Edward. Over Christmas, he and Ethel took their children on a skiing vacation in Aspen, and when, at the beginning of January 1964, he returned, tanned, to Washington, he seemed, to reporters who didn't know him well, to have recovered himself. Returning to his office at Justice, smiling, joking with the staff, he was, they wrote, relaxed, his old self. Pledging loyalty to the new administration, he said he would remain in office at least through the election. I'll do whatever anybody, the president or the Democratic National Committee, feels will be helpful. The pledge itself merited headlines. Robert Kennedy staying on. Seeing the desolation in his wasted face when the smile faded, those closer to him remained uncertain about despair's defeat. To look into his eyes was to know the suffering he had endured, a friend says. Though he was back in the office, his administrative assistant Siegenthaler says that, I didn't have the feeling that he really was part of the world in which he was working. I mean, he was doing the job, answering the correspondence. When I say he was not functional, I don't mean that he was not able to do what he had to do, or that he didn't know what he was doing. It was more that he did what he did through that sort of haze of pain that he felt. Calling on him in his office in February, the columnist Murray Kempton, an old friend, noticed that he hadn't regained any weight, that his collar was still a little too large and his cuffs a little too close to his knuckles, not as though he had wasted, but as though he had withdrawn. The telephone rang. The caller happened to be a friend of Kempton's. Bobby handed him the phone, and Kempton began to banter and laugh with the friend. Then he glanced over at Robert Kennedy. The Attorney General was sitting and looking at his hands, and his face was a face horribly lonely for a time when it had been part of a community with a place in it for careless laughter. New lines had been carved into his forehead and around his mouth. There was, suddenly, gray in the mop of ginger hair. How his face had aged in the years I had known him, a friend thought. How do I look? He asked Siegenthaler. You look like hell, Siegenthaler replied. I can't sleep. I can't sleep, Bobby said. He still, that February, drove at night to his brother's grave, still wore the talismanic bomber jacket and tweed overcoat. On St. Patrick's Day, almost 4 months after November 22nd, he would be talking to Mary McGrory, whom in the old days he had once picked up and slung, the two of them laughing over his shoulder. Trying to comfort him, she said, "You're young and you're going to be productive and successful." Suddenly burying his head in her shoulder, he gave a cry of anguish and she would recall, burst into tears. Time may have been blunting, slightly, the pain and desolation. It wasn't curing it. Time would never cure it. Almost a half-century later, when she was the only one of the nine Kennedy siblings still living, the author would ask Jean Kennedy Smith about her brother Bobby and his depression over Jack's death. "When did he come out of that?" she repeated, and then said, "I don't think he ever came out of that." Some explanations for grief of such vivid intensity were obvious. The brother who had died was not just a brother, but a brother with whom Robert Kennedy had been so close that they finished each other's sentences, or communicated without any words at all, in a perfect, almost telepathic understanding. Strong-willed though Robert Kennedy was, he had at an early age subordinated his own aims and ambitions to his brother's, had subordinated them, submerged them completely, investing himself totally in John Fitzgerald Kennedy's destiny. "Now he is alone," Kempton wrote. Bobby explained it to a reporter that he had to find a goal for the first time in his life because for as long as he could remember, he had no goal that was not his brother's. Says a friend, it was almost as if a part of him had died. Nor, on a less subjective level, was it merely a brother he had lost. In an instant, in the crack of a gunshot, he had lost power, too. "What is different now and what makes me sad is that I see a problem or someone tells me about a problem and I can't do anything about it," he told Kempton. "There was this time when if people had something and couldn't see my brother, they could always see me and I could pick up the phone and call him. It's strange to think that you can't just pick up the phone." Obvious as were these explanations, however, as weeks turned into months without the wound showing any signs of healing, friends began to wonder if there were less obvious ones as well. Siegenthaler was to say that he sensed in the months after JFK's assassination that Robert Kennedy seemed haunted, as if he was holding something back. To those searching for other explanations, there may, or may not, have been clues. Though Robert Kennedy's grief was understandable, his biographer Evan Thomas would write, yet it seemed too overwhelming, so all-consuming. McCone of the CIA, a close friend, remembered that when he arrived at Hickory Hill not long after the terrible news, Bobby had asked him whether his agency was connected with the assassination. Bobby was later to say that he had asked McCone, a fellow Catholic, in a way that he couldn't lie to me, and that McCone's answer had satisfied him that the CIA had not been involved. In 1975, when during a congressional investigation, the CIA's assassination plots against Fidel Castro were revealed, McCone, suddenly recalling that question, had a flash of recognition. He had felt at the time that there was something troubling Kennedy that he was not disclosing, Thomas says. Operation Mongoose was still active on November 22nd. There had been 8 separate CIA-sponsored assassination attempts on Castro's life since the beginning of 1961. Whether or not Robert Kennedy had been personally involved, did Castro feel he had been? That the Kennedys had been? Did the assassination in Dallas have anything to do with the attempts in Havana? During that 1975 investigation, as he learned more about anti-Castro intrigues, McCone, as Thomas writes, began to suspect that Kennedy felt personally guilty for what had happened in Dallas. Friends remembered remarks Kennedy had made not about Cuba, but about the target of his other unrelenting campaign. On December 9th, Arthur Schlesinger asked Robert, perhaps tactlessly, about Oswald. He said that there could be no serious doubt that he was guilty. But he added there was doubt, argument was the word he used, about something else, whether he did it by himself or as part of a larger plot, whether organized by Castro or by the gangsters. Ben Bradley remembered President Kennedy, obviously serious, telling him once that the Justice Department had discovered that an underworld enforcer had been given a gun fitted with a silencer and sent to Washington to assassinate the Attorney General. When later the publicity-hunting New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison claimed to have discovered that the Dallas shootings, the 2 shootings, were part of an elaborate conspiracy, Kennedy asked his press secretary, Frank Mankiewicz, if he thought Garrison had anything. No, but I think there is something, Mankiewicz replied. So do I, Bobby said. Although he may, as Thomas says, have been worried that his own aggressive pursuit of evil men had brought evil upon his own house, Robert Kennedy never went beyond such cryptic remarks, never told the Warren Commission of his suspicions about mobsters or Cuban exiles, never in public cast doubt on the single gunman theory, never tried to have a more thorough investigation undertaken. He never quieted his own doubts, Thomas writes. Though his restless mind continued to torment him, he was unwilling to go where the facts might lead. He never pursued the question of who or why. He never really wanted any investigation, Katzenbach says. He just wanted to close the book. He wondered, Schlesinger recorded in his journal after a talk with Robert Kennedy in 1966, how long he could continue to avoid comment on the Warren Commission report. It is evident that he believes that it was a poor job and will not endorse it, but that he is unwilling to criticize it and thereby reopen the whole tragic business. Such clues may, however, be clues to nothing at all. I cannot say what his essential feeling was, Schlesinger finally had to confess, and neither, perhaps, can anyone else. No one knows whether there are explanations for Robert Kennedy's grief beyond the obvious ones. Half a century after John